Jamie led the way back into the tower and up the stairs, moving at a fast walk that threatened frequently to break out into a run, but somehow never quite did. Hawk admired Jamie's self-control. It was only the McNeil's example that kept him from taking the steps two at a time at a dead run. They were getting close to the answers now. He could feel it in his gut. He was still cautious enough to keep a watchful eye on his surroundings, but nothing moved in the shadows, and the only sound on the quiet was their own hurried footsteps and harsh breathing. Hawk kept a firm grip on his sword hilt. It was all too easy. Somehow, in some way Hawk didn't understand, the freak was leading them around by the nose. They had to be doing exactly what he wanted, or he'd have attacked them by now. It was the only explanation that made sense. They arrived at the third floor, breathing heavily from the stairs, and Jamie strode briskly down the corridor. He stopped before a featureless stretch of wall and waited impatiently for the others to catch up. Hawk studied the brickwork dubiously. It looked no different from any other stretch of wall.
Are you sure this is the right place?
Of course I'm sure. I grew up here. I know every floor and every room of Tower McNeil like the back of my own hand. For example...
He walked back a dozen paces and pressed a piece of stone scrollwork. A section of stone wall swung slowly open on concealed hinges, revealing a dark, narrow passage.
It's one of the old secret stairways. Ends up in the library. One of the more useful shortcuts built into the tower.
He pushed the section of wall shut, and it locked silently back into position, with nothing to show it had ever opened.
Very impressive. I'll remember it if I'm in a hurry. In the meantime, if there is a room behind this wall, how do we get in? Break the wall down?
That may not be necessary.
They all turned to Alistair.
Look closely. This particular stretch of brickwork seems more modern than the rest.
They all looked. Hawk was damned if he could see any difference, but he didn't say so.
Look for a hidden catch or lever. Something that doesn't quite fit, or that seems somehow out of place.
They pressed in close to the wall, running their fingertips across the bricks and mortar, and staring intently at every crack and crevice. In the end, Jamie was the one who found the lever. It was disguised as one of the lamp brackets, and Jamie noticed it was a slightly different design than the ones on either side of it. He gave it a good hard tug, and it tilted out of the wall. There was a hesitant rumbling of hidden machinery, and then a section of the wall swung open. Jamie stepped forward to look inside, and Hawk moved quickly in beside him, sword at the ready. The room was small and featureless, lit only by daylight filtering through a narrow slit window. It was completely empty. Hawk scowled and lowered his sword as Mark and Alistair crowded in behind him.
Why go to all the trouble of setting up a concealed room and then not use it? That's crazy.
Not really. This is probably meant for use as a last-ditch bolt hole in times of trouble or unrest. There was a time, not that many kings ago, when the McNeils weren't too popular at court. They made the mistake of telling the king the truth instead of what he wanted to hear, and had the impertinence to stick up for their friends, even when those friends fell out of favor. The McNeils always did have more loyalty than sense. Anyway, this was probably intended as a hiding place for guests the McNeils weren't supposed to be talking to, or maybe as a refuge for women and children if the tower fell under siege. We McNeils haven't survived this long without learning a few tricks along the way.
Damn right. Never trust in the gratitude of kings or politicians. They all have bloody short memories when they feel like it.
Hawk nodded politely, disguising his interest. He didn't know the McNeils had a history of bad relations with the court. That might explain why Fenris went to ground at Tower McNeil in the first place.
This is all very interesting, but do you think we could please get a move on? We have two more rooms to find, and the less time we spend on our own up here, the better.
The lad's right. We've left the women alone too long as it is.
They're protected. They'll be all right till we get back.
Some protection. A dandy, a drunk, and two old men. There's no telling what might have happened while we've been gallivanting about up here.
Then let's stop wasting time arguing and look for the other two rooms. Jamie, is there a tool cupboard or something like that up here?
Of course. Why?
Well, it just occurred to me that we might not be able to find the hidden mechanisms for the other two rooms. We might have to get into them the hard way, with sledgehammers and crowbars.
Good thinking. Well, Jamie?
This way.
Jamie stepped out from the room and started off down the corridor.
Leave the door open. We might need to find the room again in a hurry.
They found the tool cupboard easily enough, but sorting through the contents took some time. Jamie had never actually looked into it before. That was what servants were for, and he found the contents fascinating, discovering all kinds of things he didn't know he had. He rummaged away happily while everyone else helped themselves to what they wanted. Alistair and Mark both chose crowbars, hefting them with obvious unfamiliarity, while Hawk went straight for a short-handled sledgehammer with a large flat head. He liked the feel and weight of it. It reminded him of his axe. He swung it easily a few times and stuck it through his belt. Everyone then had to wait while Jamie searched for a hammer just like Hawk's. He swung it a few times, then led the way back down the corridor to the next hidden room. The hallway grew darker as they moved along. The tower's architect saw no reason to waste expensive glass windows on a storage level used mainly by servants, and mostly made do with arrow slits. There were lamp brackets on the walls at regular intervals, but with all the servants gone, not one lamp burned. The group moved from one pool of light to another, plunged occasionally into gloom as clouds passed before the sun, cutting off the daylight. Hawk peered watchfully about him, his free hand resting on the hammerhead. The second stretch of brickwork Jamie indicated looked just as innocuous as the first. Hawk tried all the lamp brackets in the vicinity, but nothing happened. A thorough search of the bricks and mortar failed to turn up any other hidden catches or levers, so they did it the hard way. Hawk and Jamie rolled up their sleeves, Jamie clumsily following Hawk's example. They set to work with their sledgehammers on what looked like the weakest spot. The old brickwork gave way surprisingly easily, and they soon opened up a hole big enough for Alistair and Mark to work on with their crowbars, while Hawk and Jamie took a rest. When the hole looked big enough, everyone stepped back to let Jamie peer into the gloom beyond. Mark leaned against the wall.
Well, what's in there?
Looks like a writing desk. There are papers on it. Oh, I've got to get in there. We have to widen the hole some more.
Jamie stepped back, and between them, the group knocked and levered away bricks until the hole was big enough for Jamie to squeeze through. Hawk clambered through after him and then quickly turned to stop Mark and Alistair following him.
You'd better stay where you are. This looks like a really bad place to be cornered in. Watch the corridor. We'll yell out if we find anything interesting.
Alistair turned away, his back radiating disapproval. Mark just nodded and took up a post as lookout. Hawk moved over to join Jamie, who was leaning over the desk, shuffling through a sheaf of papers and squinting at them in the meager light from the slit window. There was a lamp on the desk. Hawk picked it up and shook it and heard oil gurgle. He raised an eyebrow. Someone had been in the room recently, which meant there was a way in that they'd missed. He shrugged and lit the lamp, holding it over the papers. The crabbed handwriting was difficult to read, even with the additional light, but Hawk was able to make out enough of it to give him goose flesh. The author had to be the freak's father. Jamie struggled with the handwriting.
Damn. These are old, Richard. Really old. I need to study them. This bit here seems to be written directly after the freak was walled up and left to die. Something about its unnatural appetites. There are hints here about what the freak actually is. Oh, and how to deal with it. All the things Dad never got around to telling me. Richard, we've struck gold.
Don't get too excited yet. Here's something else for you to think about. Someone was in here before us not long ago.
Jamie looked at him sharply.
How can you tell?
There was fresh oil in this lamp. What worries me is how he got in.
Presumably, there's a secret mechanism here somewhere, and we missed it.
Maybe. Maybe there isn't, and our visitor used magic.
They looked at each other for a long moment.
What are you saying?
I'm not sure, but if there is a secret magic user here in Tower McNeil, that could complicate the hell out of things.
Dad was the magic user in the family. I never had much of a gift for it myself. He could have been here while he was putting together his note for me.
Well, that's a possibility, but we can't bank on it. Let's keep this to ourselves for the time being. If there is a secret magic user among us, we don't want to spook him. Or her.
Do you think there's...
What are you two muttering about?
Alistair stuck his head in through the hole in the wall.
Nothing. We've just found some old papers, that's all. We'll check them out downstairs.
Right.
Jamie went quickly through the desk drawers and gathered up a few more papers. He rolled them all up and stuffed them inside his shirt.
Let's go. We've still got to find the third room.
They found it sooner than they expected. They rounded a curve in the corridor and stopped dead in their tracks as they saw a great hole in the wall and debris scattered across the floor. Jagged half-bricks jutted from the sides of the hole like broken teeth. and the wall itself bowed slightly outward into the corridor as though there'd been an explosion in the room beyond.
That's not possible. We passed this way less than half an hour ago, and there was no trace of this then.
It's here now.
Hawk knelt down among the rubble and examined it closely in the light of the lamp he'd brought with him from the last room.
This happened some time ago. There's a layer of dust here that hasn't been disturbed. But you're right, Jamie. We did come this way before. You can see our footprints in the dust over there. Strange. There isn't this much dust anywhere else on this floor.
What does that mean?
Beats me. Maybe the servants just didn't feel like dusting this particular bit of corridor for some reason.
Ugh. He got to his feet and moved over to inspect the broken wall.
This is interesting, too. Look at the way the bricks splay outwards. They must have been hit from the other side, from inside the room. The freak did this himself, presumably with his bare hands.
God save us. What kind of monster is it?
Alistair moved over to study the hole, scowling thoughtfully.
Nothing human could have done this. The wall was stout and heavy, built to last.
He peered through the hole at the room beyond, and his voice changed.
Richard, bring that lamp over here, would you?
Hawk did so, and the others crowded around so they could all see into the hidden room. Scattered across the floor of the tiny cell were hundreds of small bones. Among them were the bodies of several small creatures, rats and mice and other things too decayed and corrupt to identify. The room stank of age and decay like a freshly opened tomb.
Well, now we know what he ate.
It doesn't explain how they got into a bricked-up room. Besides, some of the less decayed bodies look practically untouched.
Hawk stepped back from the hole to get some fresh air, and the others gladly took this as an excuse to do the same. They looked at each other for a while, at a loss for words. Hawk nudged a brick on the floor with his foot.
Perhaps there's something in the papers that will explain this. I'll check them when we get downstairs.
There's only one explanation. Magic. Some kind of illusion. The hole in the wall was there all the time, and we walked right past it without seeing it. Hell, we must have been practically stumbling over the rubble.
So what happened to the illusion? Why are we able to see the hole now?
Perhaps we're being allowed to see it. Perhaps the freak doesn't need to hide it from us any longer.
They all looked at him.
You mean the freak knows we're here and what we're doing?
Haven't you felt you were being watched? Haven't you had that feeling right from the start?
The freak must be a magic user of some kind. He set up the illusion after he broke out. First so that the servants wouldn't see the hole, and then so that we wouldn't, until he wanted us to. Now he's hiding behind another illusion, dogging us from one floor to another, and laughing at us all the while.
Oh, delightful. Not only is he inhumanly strong and a killer, but he can play with our minds as well.
They stood quietly for a while, staring into the creature's cell, because it was easier than looking at each other and admitting they didn't know what to do next.
Think what he must have endured. Shut up in that tiny cell for years on end. No way to measure time, save by the passing of day into night, night into day. No sound save his own voice. No company save his own thoughts. And all the years passing, one into another. Did he ever understand why he'd been shut away and left to die? Except as a punishment for being different? Perhaps in the end that's what kept him alive so long. A slow-burning fuse of hatred, waiting for a chance at revenge.
Don't start feeling sorry for the creature. He's already killed one man. And he would undoubtedly kill you, given the chance.
We don't know the freak is the murderer. There's no evidence, no proof, nothing to tie him directly to the killing. For all we know, one of us may be the murderer for reasons of his own.
Hawk studied him thoughtfully, but said nothing.
We can discuss this better downstairs. It's obvious the freak isn't using his cell anymore, so there's no point in hanging around here. We've been gone a long time. The others will be worried about us.
He turned his back on the gaping hole in the wall and started off down the corridor, followed by the others. They made their way silently back down the staircase, and all the way down, Hawk thought of the dead rats in the freak's cell. He'd studied the fresher bodies very carefully, and as far as he could see, none of them had any signs of a death wound, just like the dead man in the chimney. In the drawing room, after the search party left, those left behind at first busied themselves stacking furniture against the door, but that didn't take long. The atmosphere became tense and strained. No one felt much like talking. Holly sat with her back pressed against the wall, her face pale and bloodless. She clasped her hands tightly together in her lap and jumped at every sudden noise or movement. Katrina gave up trying to get through to her and sat elegantly on her chair, sipping unhurriedly at her wine and thinking her own thoughts. Greaves and Brennan stood self-consciously on guard by the barricade. Brennan held an old short sword he took from a plaque on the wall, while Greaves held a heavy iron poker from the fireplace. The butler's cold features could have been carved in stone, as usual, while Brennan looked somehow larger and more imposing, as though having a sword in his hand awakened memories of the man he used to be. David Brooke and Lord Arthur sat close by Holly, trying to comfort her with their presence. And Fisher stood with her back to the fireplace, watching them all unobtrusively and wishing desperately for a sword. She wasn't sure she believed in the freak, but that didn't mean there was no danger. In her opinion, there were enough human killers around without having to turn to the supernatural to explain a sudden, violent death. It was much more likely the killing had something to do with the spy Fenris. She shifted her weight from one foot to the other and hoped Hawk wouldn't be long. She always thought more clearly when she had Hawk to discuss things with. Lord Arthur got up and helped himself to another drink. David glared at him.
"Don't you think you've had enough, Arthur? You're no use to us drunk."
"I'm no use to anyone, drunk or sober, Davy. You should know that. Besides, to a seasoned drinker such as myself, getting drunk isn't nearly so simple as it once was. As my system grows increasingly pickled, alcohol has less and less effect on it. I suppose eventually I shall reach a stage where alcohol has no effect on me whatsoever. But I hope and pray I shall have departed this sad vale of tears long before then. But whatever you do, Davy, don't have me cremated. There's so much booze in my body it would probably burn for a fortnight."
"Oh, don't talk that way. It's depressing."
"I'm sorry. How are you feeling now, Holly?"
"Better, I think. Do you think I could have a sip of your drink?"
"Of course."
Arthur handed her his glass.
"Approach it carefully. It's rather potent."
Holly took a cautious sip.
"Oh."
She made a face and thrust the glass back at him.
"And you drink that stuff for fun. You're tougher than you look, Arthur."
"Why, thank you, my dear. It's nice to be appreciated."
They shared a smile. David stirred impatiently.
"Don't encourage him, Holly. We might need his sword yet."
"If we ever reach the stage where everything depends on me and my poor skill with a sword, then we will be in serious trouble. I have all the fighting skills of a depressed rabbit. I never was much of a warrior. I always believed in seeing the other fellow's point of view, preferably over a glass of something. No, Davy, if trouble occurs, I have every confidence that you will defend us nobly. You're the swordsman here."
"That's right. You always had to be the hero, David, even when we were young. I'd be the captive princess, and you'd be the valiant hero in his milk-white charger come to rescue me. I always needed saving back then for some reason or another."
"I remember. I always had to be Davy's squire, even though I was the eldest. I didn't mind. My father was furious when he found out, though. 'You're a viscount,' he used to thunder. 'The son of a lord! Try to act like one!' I always was a disappointment to Dad."
Arthur shrugged and, taking a healthy sip from his drink, looked directly at Holly.
"They were good days then. When we were young and the world was so simple."
"You're getting maudlin, Arthur."
David turned to Holly and smiled reassuringly.
"There's really nothing to worry about, Holly. I'll protect you, just as I always have."
"And I'll do my bit, however small. I would defend you with my life, Holly."
Holly smiled genuinely for the first time and reached out to clasp each of them by the hand.
"Oh, I feel so safe with you two here. My guardians.
They've been gone too long. It shouldn't take them this long to check a few windows. Do you suppose something's happened to them?"
"It's too early to start panicking. They haven't been gone an hour yet."
"Is that all? It seems longer."
"It's the waiting. Time always drags when you're waiting for something to happen."
"It still seems too long. I'm sure Jamie didn't intend for us to be left alone for this length of time. Something's happened, I'm sure of it. I think someone ought to go after them and make sure everything's all right."
"Don't look at me. I may be drunk, but I'm not crazy."
"Damn right. No one's to go off on their own. It isn't safe."
"Who the hell do you think you are, giving everyone orders? Hold your tongue and remember your place. David, if Arthur hasn't the courage to go, I'm sure you'll see your way clear
to..." "Not this time, Katrina. For once, I find myself in agreement with Arthur. If the freak is roaming about out there, a man on his own would make a perfect target. And no, you can't send one of the servants either.
Thank you, sir.
Greaves bowed as Brennan grinned. Katrina slumped back in her chair and pouted.
So we just sit here and wait for them to come back, do we? What if they never come back?
They'll be back.
Holly looked at her.
How can we be so sure?
I have faith in my brother. We've been through a lot together.
Yes, I just bet you have.
Fisher looked at her with a slightly raised eyebrow, and Katrina decided to go back to her pouting. The trip down through the tower seemed to take forever. The stairs fell away endlessly before them, curling around and around the inner wall. Hawk's thighs ached from the strain, and his back ached from the tension of constantly waiting for an attack. They were at their most vulnerable on the stairs, and the freak must know it. He'd never get a better chance at them. But landing corners came and went without an ambush, and doors passed unopened. Hawk's scowl deepened. He almost wished the freak would attack and get it over with. But they reached the ground floor without incident, and Jamie led the way back to the drawing room. Hawk brought up the rear, sword at the ready, his gaze still darting from shadow to shadow. He was beginning to wish that he hadn't left the sledgehammer up on the third floor. Alistair and Mark moved close together, also with swords at the ready, almost treading on Jamie's heels. Hawk didn't blame them. It was always when you were nearly back to safety that your adrenaline really began to pump. It was only then, when you stopped thinking about your mission and started thinking about being able to relax and take it easy again, that you realized how much you had to lose if something were to go wrong at the last moment. Hawk hung back a little, giving himself room to move, and swept the surrounding corridor with a steady, professional gaze. It wasn't likely the freak would make a move now, after turning down so many other, better opportunities, but Hawk wasn't about to drop his guard just because safety was so near at hand. Jamie reached the drawing room door.
It's Jamie! We're back!
Mark and Alistair moved in close behind him, staring almost hungrily at the door as they listened to the barricade within coming apart. Hawk stood with his back to the door, watching the corridor. He looked left and right at random, careful not to give any attacker a pattern he could anticipate and elude. There was a movement to his right, and he looked sharply around to find Alistair beside him, looking slightly sheepish.
Must be getting old, forgetting to watch my back just because I'm nearly home. You'd make a good soldier, lad. You've got the right instincts. You're sure you've never had any training?
Hawk cast about for a convincing answer, but was saved by the opening of the drawing room door. Jamie hurried in, followed by Mark and Alistair. Hawk took one last look around the empty corridor, then backed unhurriedly into the drawing room. He kicked the door shut and, with help, pushed a heavy piece of furniture up against it. And then, finally, he put away his sword and allowed himself to relax a little.
Are we still in danger?
Holly and Katrina were taking turns hugging the breath out of Jamie, while David and Lord Arthur clapped Mark and Alistair on the shoulder and pumped them for details about what they'd found out. Greaves and Robbie Brennan nodded politely to Hawk as he put down his lamp, congratulated him on his safe return, and set about rebuilding the barricade. Fisher came over to Hawk and offered him a brandy, which he accepted gratefully.
Any sign of the freak?
We found his lair, but he was long gone. Jamie's got some documents that should fill us in on what the freak actually is. Apart from that, it was pretty much a wasted journey. One bit of bad news. There's a good chance the freak is a magic user. We ran into a pretty good illusion spell up around his lair.
Oh, that's all we need. Did you come across anything that might tie in with Fenris?
Not a damn thing. I'm beginning to wonder if we might have been sent on a wild goose chase. I haven't come across anything to suggest Fenris was ever here.
The Circle of Sorcerers said they tracked the spy right to Tower McNeil.
I wouldn't trust that bunch to cast my horoscope.
Are you going to tell Commander Dubois that, or shall I?
Well, the first part of the search went as expected. We marked every room without incident. But once outside, we discovered not one, not two, but three unmarked windows.
At that point, Jamie launched into an excited, only slightly exaggerated account of their journey. Fisher listened skeptically while Hawk enjoyed his brandy. He might not know much about vintages, but he knew enough not to waste a chance at a good brandy. It wasn't often he could afford the good stuff on a guard's wages. Jamie finally wound up his report and spread out the papers he'd found on one of the larger tables so that everyone could take a look at them. With perseverance and a little discreet elbowing, Hawk and Fisher made sure they got places in front of everyone else.
This is the secret of Tower McNeil.
The pages were faded and cracked and written in several different hands, running from the time of the freak's birth to well after his incarceration. One writer was definitely the freak's father. The others could have been anyone, from members of the family to some of McNeil's security people. The story that finally emerged from the assembled pages was more than a little unsettling. The family could have lived with the physical abnormalities exhibited by the freak at birth. Occasional unfortunates were inevitable when the quality became as inbred as it had in Haven. It wasn't until the child grew older that they discovered just how inhuman he really was. The freak didn't need food or drink. He drained the life force out of anyone and anything that came within arm's reach of him. At first, no one understood what was happening. When those close to the child fell ill and listless, they just put it down to a bug that was going around. Then someone gave the freak a puppy for his 6th birthday, and the family watched in horror as he drained the life right out of it. The freak laughed delightedly and clapped his hands again and again, glowing with health and vitality, while the puppy lay shriveled and still on the carpet. After that, the freak lived in isolation. Poultry and small animals were provided to satisfy his unnatural appetites, but no one save his mother and father ever saw him again, and they were always careful to visit him only after he'd just been fed. The father spent years searching for a cure, almost bankrupting the family in the process, and then the mother went to visit her son one day and never came back. By the time the household realized she was missing, it was far too late. His father found him squatting beside her body, singing in her voice. The McNeil almost fainted with shock when the monstrous child addressed him in his dead wife's voice. It seemed he didn't just suck the life out of people, he took their memories as well. The freak actually thought he was his own mother, for a time. The McNeil finally did what his family had been begging him to do for years. He ordered a secret room constructed on the 3rd floor and walled up the freak inside. Since the boy was only 10 years old, the McNeil gave him poison to drink first. It didn't work. The freak lived on, draining the strength out of anyone who passed by his room. The McNeil was at his wit's end. Since he'd already told everyone the freak was dead and established his 2nd son as heir, he didn't dare go outside the family for help. So he did the only thing he could. He evacuated the tower and left it empty long enough to weaken the freak. He hoped the freak would die, but it didn't. He could hear it screaming. Eventually, he went back inside and made a small opening in the wall and fed his son a rat. He slowly taught the freak to drain only food that was offered and not the person who fed him. It took a long time, but the McNeil was patient. And when the freak finally learned, he let his family back into Tower McNeil. They couldn't leave the tower permanently. People were already asking questions, and they couldn't kill the freak. His magic grew as he grew older, tapping into people's minds until they were afraid to antagonize him. As long as he was fed regularly, he remained quiet, and the family learned to live with it. Years passed. One by one, everyone who knew about the freak died, until it became a family secret, handed down from father to eldest son. Feed the freak what he wanted, and he would remain quiet. And so it went, down the many years. The freak lived on in his cell, until finally Duncan McNeil grew careless and never got around to telling his new eldest son. He died in battle, and the supply of living food stopped, and the freak woke up hungry.
The rest of it seems fairly obvious. He drained the servants to begin with, as they passed unknowing by the hidden room. Remember the colds they kept getting? Then he broke out and drained all the life out of someone.
The dead man in the chimney! But why did he burn the victim's face?
I think I know, but you're not going to like it. Remember, when he drained his mother, he acquired her voice and memories, even thought he was her for a time. I think he took one of your guests, Jamie, destroyed the victim's face so it couldn't be recognized, and then took his place. Only the memories were so strong, after so many years' abstinence. The freak forgot who he was and thought he was the person he'd killed. That's why we haven't been attacked. Because one of us is the freak and doesn't know it.
For a long moment, they all just stood there and looked at him.
That's ridiculous. How could he not know what he is?
All those years alone must have driven him crazy. Maybe his own personality had become so fragile.
Wait a minute. What about the illusion on the cell wall? The freak kept that up for a while, and then dropped it when he realized it wasn't needed anymore. How could the freak do that, if he doesn't remember who he is?
Maybe he remembers sometimes when he has to protect himself. How should I know? I'm not an expert on freaks or madness.
You're accusing one of us of being the freak? That's crazy. Jamie, tell him it's crazy.
Be quiet, Auntie.
Katrina looked at him reproachfully, but his face was stern and uncompromising. At that moment, he looked every inch the McNeil, head of the family, and Katrina subsided, limiting herself to a couple of bad-tempered sniffs. Jamie looked hard at Hawk.
If one of us is a murderer, and truly doesn't know it, how can we tell who it is?
Perhaps there's something in the documents, something we missed.
No. Young Richard has summed up the paper's contents very thoroughly. He didn't miss a thing.
We've got to do something. That creature could be leeching the life out of us even as we speak.
Has anybody felt ill recently? Does anyone feel tired or listless?
They all looked at each other, but nobody said anything. Hawk frowned as he tried to judge how he felt. After the hectic events of the past night and early morning, he'd have been surprised if he hadn't felt a little frayed around the edges, but he couldn't say he felt unusually tired. He cocked an eyebrow at Fisher, and she shook her head slightly.
We have to find the freak. Find him and kill him. He's too dangerous to be allowed to live.
Right. If we don't find him before he feeds again, he could be the only living thing left in this tower when the wards go down tomorrow morning.
Holly paled suddenly and turned away. Arthur looked hard at David.
Steady on, old chap. You're frightening the girls.
Shut up, Arthur. This is serious.
Are you sure we can kill the freak? He's not human. Perhaps he can't be killed by ordinary methods.
Alistair nodded thoughtfully.
You mean like silver for a werewolf and a wooden stake for a vampire?
Perhaps the reason why they didn't kill him is because they couldn't. If that is the case, the wisest thing to do would be to lock ourselves up in our rooms, barricade the doors, and wait it out till morning. As soon as the wards go down, we could make a run for it.
And leave the freak free to attack the city? Hundreds of people could die before he was finally hunted down and destroyed. The secret of the McNeils would become the shame of the McNeils. I can't allow that. The freak is our responsibility. It's a family problem, and we have to deal with it.
Besides, splitting up is a bad idea. There's safety in numbers.
So you keep saying. What's the matter, Richard? Can't you cope without someone to hold your hand?
That's enough, David! Richard's done very well by us so far. Now listen to me, all of you. There's still one source of information we haven't consulted, and that is my father's will. There may be something in the will that can help us, so Greaves and I will set up the right conditions for the reading. It may take a little time, and I think we could all use a break to freshen up. So I suggest you all repair to your rooms and compose yourselves until we're ready down here. But, just to be on the safe side, I think it might be wise if no one was to be left on their own. So, choose a partner and stick with them at all times. Happy now, Richard?
Not really, but it's better than nothing. I'll look after my sister.
Of course. Aunt Katrina, if you'd be so kind as to look after Holly?
The others sorted themselves out. David and Arthur paired up together, leaving Mark and Alistair to form the final pair. Neither of them looked too happy about it, but they both made diplomatic noises. Brennan realized he was left on his own and quickly volunteered to help set up the reading of the will. There was a pause after that as everyone waited for everyone else to make the first move. Jamie broke the mood by nodding curtly to Greaves and Brennan to help him dismantle the barricade at the door. It was soon done, and everyone set off up the stairs to the bedrooms on the next floor, eyeing each other suspiciously when they thought no one was looking. Hawk still wasn't happy about the group splitting up, but Jamie was the authority here, not him. He couldn't push the matter too hard without arousing suspicions. Besides, he could use the opportunity to talk with Isabel in private. He always did his best thinking when he could discuss things with Isabel. He had a strong feeling he was going to need all the help he could get on this case. Hawk and Fisher watched closely as the others disappeared into their rooms on the second floor and made careful mental notes as to whom was staying where. You never knew when information like that might come in handy. Jamie escorted Hawk and Fisher to their room and even opened the door for them.
I hope you'll be comfortable here.
Thank you. I'm sure we'll be fine. You are most gracious. I'm truly sorry for today's turn of events.
Yes. Well, thank you. I must be going now.
They all smiled at each other, and Jamie went back down the corridor. Hawk immediately closed the door, locked it, and put his back against it. Hawk's chin dropped forward onto his chest. Fisher lay stretched out, full length on the bed, indifferent to the damage it was doing to her dress.
I never knew behaving respectably could be such hard work. Done so much smiling, it feels like I went to sleep with a coat hanger in my mouth. I don't know if I can keep this up till tomorrow morning.
Huh. I don't know what you're complaining about. At least you don't have to be sociable and cope with a corset at the same time. My waist isn't on speaking terms with the rest of me. Oh!
She sat up slowly and carefully, levered off her fashionable shoes, and wriggled her toes gratefully.
Oh! I don't know how women can bear to wear those things. My feet are killing me.
Yeah. Hawk threw himself into the nearest chair, slumped back, and stretched out his legs before him. It felt good to be able to relax, even if only for a while. The chair was almost sinfully comfortable, and Hawk closed his eyes, the better to appreciate it. Some moments were just too precious to be interrupted. But it didn't last. There were too many more important things clamoring for his attention. He opened his eyes reluctantly and glanced around the room Jamie gave them. Just on the off chance he'd spot something that would let him ignore his problems for a while, till he felt better able to deal with them. The room looked back, determined not to be helpful. It was fairly luxurious as far as quality standards went, and quality standards went pretty far. There were thick rugs on the floor, an assortment of classically elegant furniture, and a bed with a mattress deep enough to swim in. Paintings of famous military scenes covered the walls. Military art was in that season. And a half a dozen small nude statuettes smiled and posed tastefully on alabaster pedestals. And over by the window, half hidden by drapes heavy enough to block out the harshest sunlight, stood the room's own private liquor cabinet. Hawk smiled. Now that was what he called civilized. He started to lever himself up out of his chair, but Fisher intercepted his gaze and shook her head firmly.
You've had enough for one day, Hawk. Let's try and concentrate on the matter at hand. Namely, what the hell is going on here? Every time I think I've got it worked out, something else happens that throws it all back up in the air again.
It's not really as confusing as it seems. It just looks that way because we don't have all the facts yet. Or if we do, we haven't got them arranged in the right order. What's really complicating the hell out of things is that we're dealing with two separate cases here. On the one hand, we have an escaped killer freak, disguised as one of us by an illusion, while on the other hand, we have our missing spy, Fenris, disguised as one of us by a shape change. We can't sort the two cases out because they keep interfering with each other, and we can't tell which evidence belongs to which case.
Could that be deliberate?
Fisher thoughtfully massaged her left foot and stared off into the distance.
Maybe Fenris recognized us despite our disguises and let the freak loose himself as a way of throwing us off his trail.
I don't think so. The way we look now, our own creditors wouldn't know us. And from the mess the freak made of his cell wall, I don't think he needed any help in getting out. But certainly Fenris could be using the situation to keep the waters muddy. I would, in his shoes.
He might know who we are, regardless of our disguises. There could be a leak at headquarters. Hell, half the force is on the take these days, one way or another.
True. But how many people actually know about us? Commander Dubois, Mistress Melanie, and that sorcerer doctor, Wolfgang. That's all.
That's enough. Whatever information Fenris has, it must be pretty important to have panicked the Council so badly. And if it's that important, it must be worth a lot of money to the right people.
All right. There's a chance Fenris knows who we really are. Which means we can't trust anyone here.
What's new about that?
I can't believe we've been here all this time and we're still no nearer to identifying Fenris. Look, we know Fenris went to the Sorcerer Grimm for an emergency shape change. That means the body he's got now is in his usual one. Which means we can eliminate all the people here who can prove they've had the same form for more than 24 hours.
That's brilliant, Hawk. Why didn't we think of that before?
Well, we have been rather preoccupied.
Right. So, that cuts out Jamie, Katrina, and Holly, and the two servants, Greaves and Brennan.
And Lord Arthur. I've met him before. And since Arthur and Jamie have both known David for some time, that just leaves Alistair and Mark.
Hawk nodded slowly to himself.
We've already established Alistair is lying about where he comes from. He didn't know the Red Marches are flooded these days.
Yes, but he does seem to know a hell of a lot about McNeil family history. How would our spy know things like that?
He could if he was a friend of the McNeils in his true form. According to Jamie, his family has a long history of bad feelings with the court. That would explain why Fenris made a beeline for Tower McNeil in the first place. But, on the other hand...
We shouldn't dismiss Mark out of hand. Do we have any actual evidence against him?
Nothing so far. He's a quiet sort. Hasn't much to say for himself at the best of times. Doesn't seem to care much for us, but we can't drag him off in chains just for that. But... And all the time we've been here, Mark hasn't volunteered one thing about his past. Not a single damn thing about who or what he was before he came to Tara McNeil. That's interesting.
Just because he hasn't opened up to us doesn't mean he hasn't talked to the others.
True. So, for the time being, I think we'll concentrate our attention on Alistair, as far as finding the spy is concerned. Tracking down the freak is going to be more difficult.
Why? Once again, it has to be someone not well known by the others. The freak might have taken on someone else's memories, but he's still stuck with his own face. So, we're back to Mark and Alistair again. And if Alistair is Fenris, then Mark has to be the freak, right?
Hawk shook his head regretfully.
Nice try, Isabel. Unfortunately, it's not that simple.
Somehow I just knew you were going to say that. All right. What have I missed this time?
You're forgetting the illusion spell the freak cast to cover up the hole in the wall on the third floor. It's quite possible the freak is still messing with our minds to make us see someone else's face instead of his own. Which means he could be anyone, male or female. And with complete access to that person's memories, there's no way anyone's going to trip him up with an unexpected question.
So where does that leave us?
Wait, it gets worse. It seems to me the freak may be interfering with our minds in other subtler ways as well. Jamie seemed quite determined to split up the group, despite everything I've said, and everyone else just went along with it. Which is rather unusual, considering this bunch can't normally agree on anything without several minutes worth of arguments, insults, and recriminations. Perhaps the freak influenced everyone to accept Jamie's idea in order to make us easier targets.
Fisher looked at him thoughtfully, still holding her bare foot absently in her hand.
It's possible, I suppose. But how could we tell, one way or the other? And besides, if they're all being influenced, why aren't we? If the freak was controlling the way we think, then this idea wouldn't have occurred to us at all. Would it?
That's a good question. Wish I had a good answer.
Hell, I'd settle for a bad one.
Holly sat unhappily in her chair by the fire while Katrina Dorriman studied her makeup in the dressing table mirror.
I look quite good. Not a day over 25. Not bad for being past 40. Graham never did appreciate me.
She smiled. Graham might not have, but there were those who had. Sometimes in Graham's own bed. He never was very observant. She pouted at her reflection. It was all his fault anyway. If he hadn't spent all his spare time and money on his silly politics instead of lavishing it on her, they might still be together.
I told him right from the start that I was prepared to put up with a lot of things from him, but I expected his attention at all times. I realized he had commitments. I just wanted him to be there when I needed him. What was so unreasonable about that?
Things were different when they first met. He fell all over her then, bright and witty and attentive, always ready with a smile or a compliment or an out-of-season flower. When he finally worked up the nerve to ask her to marry him, long after she decided to accept, he promised her faithfully that she'd always come first with him. Graham was always very big with promises. She should have remembered that promises were a politician's stock in trade. He was so funny, then. She missed his sense of humor more than anything. He could always make her laugh, no matter how dark the day. Still, she didn't do so badly for herself once she left him. She ran up the bills, and he paid them, just as always. And why not? That was what men were for, among other things. She smiled.
Now, Richard McNeil is an unexpected bonus. Tall and dark, if no longer completely handsome, and wonderfully innocent in the ways of the world. He all but blushed every time I looked at him.
She thought of pulling the front of her dress down another inch to show off more cleavage, but thought better of it. It would undoubtedly scandalize Jamie, and she couldn't afford to get on his wrong side at the moment.
Dear Jamie, so young and already so prudish. Never even had a girlfriend, as far as I know. I'll have to do something about that once this nonsense is over and done with. In the meantime, better to concentrate on Richard. He needs encouraging.
She produced a small silver makeup case from inside her sleeve, opened it, and pawed thoughtfully through the contents.
Aunt Katrina, what are you doing?
Oh, you've decided to come out of your snit at last. I thought you were going to sulk all day because Jamie paired you off with me instead of your precious David.
I was not sulking.
Of course not, dear. You were just thinking very hard, and that's what made you frown. Now, be a pet and don't interrupt while Auntie fixes her face.
Katrina removed what looked like a tiny black spot from the makeup case. She balanced it on the tip of her finger and pressed it firmly onto the right side of her face, just above the jawline. It was quite definitely heart-shaped. Katrina turned her face back and forth, studying the effect in the mirror.
Aunt, what is that?
It's a beauty spot, dear. They're all the rage. And I do wish you'd call me Katrina, especially when we're in company. Aunt makes me feel positively ancient.
A beauty spot? What's the point of it?
The point is to attract a young man's interest. Beauty spots are supposedly there to cover some minor flaw or defect. This intrigues the young gentleman as to what that flaw might be and how he might get a look at it. Personally, I just think they look pretty.
It's not really my style.
Yes, well, at your age, you don't need such artifices. Gods, I'd kill for a complexion like yours. Still, at least you're taking an interest in things again. How are you feeling now, Holly, dear?
Better, I suppose. I'm sorry I went all to pieces downstairs, but it all just got too much for me. I've not been sleeping well recently. I'm sure I could cope a lot better if I wasn't so tired all the time.
Katrina sighed and put away her makeup case. She turned to look at Holly sternly.
Have you been taking that potion the doctor prescribed?
Yes. It doesn't help. It doesn't stop me dreaming. And that's why I don't sleep. I'm afraid to. It's always the same dream. I'm lying in bed, in the dark, unable to move. And there's something in the room with me. I can't see it, but I know it's there. It comes slowly closer, creeping towards the foot of my bed. I can hear its heavy footsteps and its harsh breathing. And I know it wants to do something to me, something horrible. I know I'm dreaming and I try to wake myself up, but I can't. It starts to heave itself up onto the end of my bed. I can feel the mattress sink down around my feet, feel the creature's horrid weight on my legs, and I try to scream, but I can't make a sound. And that's when I finally wake up. Only each night, the creature seems to get a little further before I can wake myself up. And that's why I'm so afraid to sleep. Because I know that one night I am not going to wake up in time.
You poor dear.
Katrina got up and moved quickly over to kneel beside Holly.
Why didn't you tell the doctor all this?
Oh, I did. He said it wasn't that unusual a dream for a girl my age. And advised Jamie to get me married off as soon as possible. I wasn't supposed to hear that, but I was listening outside the door. Jamie said he'd think about it. But my dream is real. I know it. And that's why I began praying for the family guardian to come and save me. He's my only hope now.
Katrina's eyes narrowed.
Men. Now, don't you worry, Holly. As soon as this nonsense is over, I'll see Jamie gets you the best doctors and specialists in Haven. They'll find out what's really wrong with you and what to do about it. In the meantime, you need something to take your mind off things. Come with me, dear. Come on.
She took Holly firmly by the arm and dragged her over to the dressing table.
Oh, no, Aunt Katrina, I couldn't.
Ignoring Holly's protests, Katrina sat her down before the mirror and retrieved her makeup case from her sleeve. She took hold of Holly's chin and turned her face back and forth, frowning thoughtfully as she studied the girl's pale and tired features in the mirror.
Don't you worry about a thing, dear. Auntie is going to remake your face from top to bottom. You won't know yourself when I'm finished. Then you can walk into the will reading with your head held high and knock them all dead. David isn't going to believe his eyes the next time he sees you. Oh,
but Katrina, I don't wear makeup. Jamie doesn't allow it.
Oh, hush, dear, and let Auntie work. You think about David, not Jamie. I'll take care of him.
Mark and Alistair sat stiffly in chairs on opposite sides of the room, carefully not looking at each other. They'd taken turns freshening up in the adjoining bathroom, and now they were waiting to be called downstairs for the reading of the will. In all the time they'd been alone together, they hadn't exchanged a dozen words. Alistair crossed and uncrossed his legs and drummed his fingers on the arm of the chair. He glanced briefly at the liquor cabinet and looked away. That wasn't what he was here for. His family needed his help, and he wouldn't let them down. He looked around the room Jamie had given him. There'd been quite a few changes in the decor since he was last here. He didn't like them.
Too gaudy by half. But fashions change, and I have been away a hell of a long time.
He looked over at Mark, who was sitting perfectly still, staring at nothing, his face as inscrutable as ever.
Is this what the family has come to? A cold fish like him? The McNeil blood must be running pretty damn thin these days. The man looks more like a funeral director than a young blade of the quality.
Alistair stirred impatiently.
Why doesn't the man say something? He just sits there. It's intensely irritating.
There were things Alistair needed to say, things he needed to discuss with someone, important things.
But who does Jamie pair me off with? An undertaker under a vow of silence, with all the open emotions of a garden statue.
Alistair settled back in his chair and put a curb on his impatience. He shouldn't be too hard on the lad. After all, Mark was all alone and a long way from home. He was probably just shy and ill at ease. He could be waiting for Alistair to make the first move. Alistair ran through half a dozen possible openings designed to lead the conversation around to what he wanted to talk about. But faced with Mark's cold visage, they all seemed either fatuous or foolish. All right, then. To hell with being polite. Be direct. Alistair leaned forward in his chair and fixed Mark with his gaze.
You've been doing a lot of thinking, young Mark. Who do you think the freak is?
Mark met the older man's gaze unflinchingly.
It could be any of us. If Richard is right, and the creature truly no longer remembers what it is, then I suppose it could even be you or I, and we wouldn't know. It's a frightening thought. The possibility that one might not be who one thinks, but actually someone else entirely. And yet I'm not sure that I agree with Richard. In order to pass as one of us, the freak must be maintaining a fairly complex illusion spell. How could he do that and not be aware of what he is?
I don't know, but the mind is a funny thing. Maybe part of him remembers, just enough to protect him without breaking the hold his new memories have on him. But even so, we're still dealing with someone who spent most of his life going crazy in solitary confinement. Even with his new memories to lean on, he's bound to find himself in situations he can't cope with. And that's when his true nature can't help but reveal itself.
I take it you're about to suggest someone you think has been acting out of character.
Exactly. I don't like the way Richard's been acting. He's from a very minor branch of the family, lives in the middle of nowhere, and by his own account, has spent most of his life with his nose in a book. But ever since we found the body, he's been taking charge, snapping out orders, and generally behaving more like a hardened soldier or a guard. It's as though he's confused the memories of who he's supposed to be with those of the people he read about. And out of all of us, he's always seemed the least scared. Perhaps because deep down, he knows he's got nothing to worry about.
You may have something there. I've been watching Richard, too. He was very quick on picking up the freak story from the papers Jamie found, wasn't he? Have you told anyone else of your suspicions?
Only Jamie. He won't listen to me.
We need evidence. All we have at the moment are suspicions. We can't condemn a man purely on doubts and theories.
We'll get evidence. All we have to do is watch him. Sooner or later, he'll give himself away. And then I'll kill him with my bare hands.